Hey there, it's Mike Tramp, and you're listening to White Lion Fever, where rock and roll is still alive like it always has been, and it always will be.
Welcome to White Lion Fever. It's a new episode for you. My name's Steve Mascord, but it's the final part of our interview here with the Wild, Dylan Villain. How are you, mate?
Doing great, man. How are you?
Good, good. We were just talking off air about, Australian bands, and you brought one up, Airborne. You've previously toured with Wolf Mother, and I know you are mates with the Lazies. We in Australia, maybe we tell ourselves there's an Australian rock sensibility. There's a certain sound, there's a certain way. Angry Anderson says the way a guitar sounds when it's played by Australian is slightly different. Are we kidding ourselves, or is there something those bands have in common? Is there something there?
Well, first of all, you know, aside from all those great Australian rock bands that you named that we've toured with, we've also toured with Rose Tattoo several times.
Yep.
Those guys have been incredibly instrumental in our career right before we even knew them, because of the sound that they, along with, of course, AC/DC and, you know, the Angels and so many other great, Jimmy Barnes. Like, there's so many great Australian rock bands, and there is, Angus completely on, he's completely on point with when he says it. I've heard him talk about it in detail, and we've actually talked about it. We've discussed it several times. For him, it's the guitarist. It's the thing that he likes to, bring up in his quotes, and he's not wrong at all. I mean, look at how many great Australian guitarists there are. Bob Spencer, I mean, Angus Young, Malcolm Young, of course. Like, there's, I could go on. But for me personally, what I think where it really lies is in the backbeat of the drums. There's something about Australian drummers that play proper Aussie pub rock or rock and roll or rockabilly, even in punk rock. You know, there's bands like The Living End, also a fantastic, punk side of rockabilly rock and roll band from Oz. And there's something about the backbeat of the drummers of these bands. I mean, Phil Rudd is one of the kings of it, in my opinion. And it's I've analyzed it. I've spoke about it with drummers, other drummers, and there's just something about that rhythm. There's something about the way that these Aussie bands and Aussie drummers can play this rhythm that I've never really heard anybody else do it quite like it. So I don't think he's wrong. I think there is really something special about just the rhythm, the natural rhythm of your people. And it's a really cool thing.
It is, it is. That's a great answer, by the way. Thank you. Before we go, I just want to ask you about the video clips, especially some of the early ones. I mean, obviously, very story-based and very funny. Obviously, they've all, right up to the most recent one, they've got high production values. And you obviously are involved in, as you've said, you've got your finger in so many pies within the band, so I'm sure that you're directly responsible for that. How... Can you make a really good video now inexpensively, or does it still cost an arm and a leg? What's the secret to getting a good video done and in an affordable way?
Yeah, it can be. I think the truth and the real trick to it all is to align yourself with somebody else who shares the right vision. It's kind of the same thing with all aspects of art. Artistic endeavors. You want to find people that are like-minded with you, that you can communicate with and get your ideas across properly. And once you have that, I find it a lot easier to get down to the brass tacks of things, so to speak. Mm. I mean, especially if somebody, like, if you're working with somebody and they really like the project and they believe in you, then all of a sudden, it becomes less about union rates or anything like this. I feel like if you're working with people that specifically do music videos, they tend to be somehow from the scene of being in a band and understand that not everybody is really, first of all, willing, has the budget to spend $50,000 on a music video. First of all, second of all, no one's really willing to spend that on a music video anymore, because let's face it, music music videos aren't even played on television anymore, so it's not even as if they're going to necessarily help your album sales, you know what I mean? So I think that you find somebody that's like-minded, that understands what you're doing, that shoots music videos, and they're under, you know, understanding of how the budget really works, and they're not afraid to do more themselves. Mm-hmm. In my experience, there's a lot of film types that want a person for this, a person for that, and a person for this. And man, like, we grew up playing in punk bands, and it's like, if you can't do five things yourself, you're in the wrong spot, man. Like, yeah. You gotta be DIY as much as you can to save that money. And you know, if I'm making a music video, and I have a budget of, you know, X amount of dollars, I'm finding ways that I can hang on to so much of that money. So it's no different than, you know, being in charge of production on a music video. You're really trying to just whittle down costs where you can and take chances and make it happen for as little as possible. So it's also like, look, there's ways of making stuff really cool and expensively. It can, as long as it looks cool, and it doesn't take much to make things look cool nowadays, as long as you know what you're doing. Mm. Aside from that, just make sure you're, you know, being true to who you are as an artist in a band and doing it how your band wants to be represented. You know, there's definitely been times where I've worked with people where they think that it should be one way, and you know, you got to be true to who you are, and you got to know, you know, what your band is all about and what, you know, that image is portraying behind your music. So yeah, it's a part and parcel, you know, one part being able to communicate with who you're working with and just knowing what you want to do.
And speaking of looking cool, last question, playing guitar on the roof of a moving police car, tell us the movie magic behind that. What actually happened? How did you manage that?
Well, we got a police car. We got it brought to set. We rented it and kept it for 3 days. And I got on the roof of it, and it drove down the road, and they played the music out of the stereo of the car, and then shot it with a drone camera.
My God. Speak about union regulations. one more song, Dylan. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, man. And everybody out there, just keep supporting the bands that you love, and rock and roll will never die. This is Bad News from the Wild. New album, Still Believe in Rock and Roll, out now. Go pick it up.
Tomorrow, and I can't look back. And the night's getting long, like my cigarette is. Trying to a devil I can't cut loose. My dues, and I'm holding on to the roller coaster in my head. Till the feeling's gone, rolling on and on. I'm bad news, and you call it walk a mile in my shoes. Now I'm out on the run. I got the cops on my ass and I don't care. I put a comb from my pocket just to snag my hair. What's up? When I'm holding on to the roller coaster in my head. Till the feeling's gone.
Telling where I've been. Now I'm down at the bottom, drowning in a bottle. Fever. Welcome back. And our guest, a fellow who, by my recollection, I last spoke to in Portland in 1990, is from LA Guns, Kelly Nichols. How are you?
How's that possible? Hey, man, how's it going?
Good, good, good. How's your day going, all right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's nice and chilly here on the East Coast, so we're doing all right.
Now, the new album Renegades is out next month, and I was just wondering, do we have Mark Alexander Erba to 100% thank for this music? Or would you, he's the CEO of Golden Robot, your new record company, or would you have recorded something anyway?
Yeah. No, we definitely have him to thank for it. I mean, we have a small part in it, but yeah, he came to us after the M3 show we did last year. It's a big festival here in Maryland. You know, he's a fan, he's into the music, he knew who we were, he's great. So we have a really good relationship. So yeah, offered us a deal, and we were going to, we weren't really going to do it right away. We were going to try to do it this year, 2020, but they wanted it done. So luckily we did it, and we have it, or else we probably wouldn't have been able to do it or have it at this point.
That's awesome. And I've read that you sort of pre-sold, like, you know, the first pressing, the second pressing, you're onto the third pressing. In one interview, he said it'll be the biggest selling LA Guns album of the last 20 years. So is that a bit of sort of exaggeration on the part of the proud boss, or is it actual fact?
Well, no, man, he loves it. So, I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, his experience and it's, you know, something that we can kind of lean on. But yeah, it seems to be some interest out there, and hopefully you know, we'll get to, you know, some people to hear it. Would be nice.
What's it like doing all this again, Kelly? Like, I think you said you didn't write a song for 25 years.
Right.
How does it feel?
It's like riding a bike, man. But, you know, I felt it was a good time to get back into it with all this happening and stuff. So, you know, it was fun. I mean, I had a great time the first time around, and, you know, always enjoyed the process and got to meet a lot of cool people through the years. So I took definitely a 25-year break and ended up back in here. And, you know, it's great to be able to have a second chance to do it all again. So I'm really excited for it. We had bunch of tour dates for this year lined up, so we were looking forward to that, but hopefully next year.
So you've been a little bit evasive in some questions about where you were for 25 years. I mean, we can find some of it on the internet. You know, you had a kid, and you know, you're involved in a reality show. But can you fill in the gaps for us?
Yeah, man. I mean, you know, I did. I raised a couple girls and had you know, just had to figure out other things to do. So I've done all kinds of things, really. I've taught some music. I've worked on a shark cage diving boat for a few years. I've done construction. I've worked in a garage. I've done all kinds of stuff just to, you know, stay busy. And still evasive.
But what confused me was that I read, and this was actually caused a little bit by this show, was that when you know, Phil Lewis said we invited him back and he didn't want to come back, and you responded by saying, we weren't invited. And then he said he wouldn't cope with it with his privileged lifestyle. Did you see that quote from Phil Lewis? He said he wouldn't cope, last for 5 minutes, with his privileged lifestyle. And I just had that in my head, that, yeah, he was a millionaire, you're like, you know, Richie Rich or something. But do you know what he meant by that? Or
you know, that was rude. I have a daughter who acts and stuff, and she does pretty well, but you know, that doesn't really reflect on my life that much, you know. So yeah, well, actually, you know, they never asked us to come back. So when Phil and Tracy started their reunion, you know, I asked if I could come back, or if, you know, I thought it would be a good idea if I came back. My youngest daughter was going to college, so I figured I had some time now. And, you know, he made it clear, no, man, they didn't want me back. So they didn't ask Mick, and they definitely didn't ask Steve. So, you know, they had a little two-man reunion. So that's kind of like the catalyst of all of this. And, you know, for us to have been in the band during its kind of heyday thing, and Steve always been doing it for the last, you know, 25 years or so, and having legal right to half the name, you know, that's how we just kind of got here, because they didn't want us, so we ended up here. So it's like it's you, you know, you're a part of something, but part of it doesn't want you in it. So what are you supposed to do? Like, are the rest of us just supposed to, like, you know, sit back and do nothing and just let them go and have a good time? You know, it didn't really work out that way. So now we're we're here too. We're here to stay.
It's really weird to see myself in each of your glasses there. Let's have a song. For the people listening, we're not going to play it for the people watching, but for the people listening, okay. What song can we play?
You could play Well-Oiled Machine, one of the new tracks off the upcoming album Renegades. Cool song about, your motorcycle. It's a love song for your motorcycle. We'll be right back. everybody. This is Kelly from LA Guns, and you're listening to White Line Fever.
Welcome back to White Line Fever, and our guest is from the Casanovas. It's Damo. Damo, how hard is it to keep a band together for 20 years? You've been going for, what, 21 years now? When, you know, you've, I guess, it's not your full-time job, and it'll be probably along during that journey, it would have been easier to quit than continue multiple times. How hard is it, and what does it require to sort of stay at it?
I don't think it was hard really for us at all. I mean, I think just you know, shit changes during the years, really. And it's, I think for us, it was always, we just wanted to create and write and, you know, write really good songs and play live and I guess play with each other as mates. And that was always the same. So, you know, that remains the same as it did when I first joined the band, which was in, was it 2001 or two or something? So a long time ago. But I think, you know, through that ride you have, when we were a lot younger, we rode the sort of success train of major labels and all that sort of thing, and got sort of taken around the world for to play in, you know, those kind of audiences. You know, we did some great tours through the years as well, and it's all experiences. And I think it's actually becomes easier the older you get, because you really start to park your egos, and it all just becomes, hey, we're good mates, we love rock and roll, we love playing with each other. So you sort of become a lot more seasoned in doing that. And once the egos are gone and there's no bullshit, it just becomes actually a lot easier.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, like, you know, being overseas, and at one point you guys had about the same level of sort of notoriety as Airborne, you know, and I guess Airborne now, you know, live on the road, and if you don't want to do it hardcore, then you're out, kind of, you know what I mean, from just being an outsider. Was there a sliding doors moment where things could have gone that way for you guys, and you had to make choices? You know, was there parallels in the two bands, because both came from Victoria, both came up around the same time? Are there any parallels?
Look, I think so. I think timing's everything, you know. And at the time when we, I guess, were at the peak of, I guess, the rock renaissance of sort of, you know, that late 90s, early 2000s period, we were courted by, you know, Lee Lust and Elektra Records, and we were over in New York, and we got passed up on. And you know, one of the reasons we got, they don't usually give you a reason, but one of the reasons we got was they had just signed an Australian rock and roll band, and that was Jet, you know. So, yeah. And what a good choice it was. But I think, you know, you can, there was a lot of things happening at that time, and I think, you know, we just missed out. And probably the sliding doors moment was perhaps we could have found an alternative way of, you know, we might have moved over to the US and done a lot more with just, you know, trying to sort of tour, do it the hard way and all that sort of thing. But we didn't. We came back to Australia and, you know, we did things our way. And look, I think in terms of notoriety and, you know, fame and fortune and all that, we didn't get that. But what we did have, and we still have, is, you know, Rubber Records. We've been with those guys on that label from the start, and we've had support from that label and been able to, whenever we want to write some songs, do an album, you know, get some support for touring, we've always had that. Mm-hmm. So whereas a lot of those bands sort of, you know, maybe got the fortunes that are plenty, that were fleeting and sort of they're kind of nowhere now, we've kind of had a lesser notoriety but slower grind where we've been able to do what we want to do, which is, you know, which is cool as well.
Yeah, yeah. Mate, I wanted to ask about the song Midlife Crisis. There's some real sort of pathos there, you know, in the grooves, and a lot of the songs are playful and fun on the album, but it's kind of a serious, it's almost like I listen to it and I want advice on how to digest that song. Am I supposed to feel sad, or am I supposed to sort of have a wry smile
and think that it's meant to be ironic and a bit of a joke. I'm wondering if you can help me there. Well, how should, when I listen to that song, how should I feel?
It's the Casanovas. It's always a wry smile.
What can you tell us about the song?
Look, that song, it's not supposed to be, you know, all broody and serious. You know, there's some funny moments in there. I think it's just probably how it comes across. It's sort of, if you take the other songs in comparison, it probably, you know, stands out a little bit that way. But it's not supposed to be. It's just a take on, hey, we're all in our 40s now, you know, so we don't feel it, but we are, and maybe this is how we're supposed to be lamenting about our older days, and that's all it is, you know.
Ado, but the ado is over, so no further ado, is Donnie V. How are you, Donnie?
I'm okay. How are you?
Yeah, really well. Now, You know, like doing the normal research that you do for an interview like this, the normal, you know, musician interviews and stuff. And then I listened to that song, All My Favorite Things, and I realized that there's a much bigger story here. There's a probably one of the, you know, a great untold lockdown narrative, you know, a pandemic, you know, story about that, that's sort of buried in the lyrics of that song. Can you fill in a few gaps for us about what happened to you before the pandemic hit and what happened after?
Yeah, the song, I didn't bury anything. It's right there out in the, right there on the table. It's just when the pandemic came, it became more universally, have more meaning to everybody, you know, than just me. I was another near-death experience. I was in the hospital and, you know, the doctor says I'm going to die and all this and that. And then obviously I lived through it. And the conditions of how I was being permitted to live and survive weren't really conditions under which I could see myself living my life. And so that's why I wrote that song. You know, I mean, I'd rather take my chances living my life than to live some life that's no life at all, you know, at least for me. And so that's what the song is about. And then the pandemic came, and then it kind of could have a meaning to everybody there at that point. You know what I mean?
I mean, I'm really
scared and you know.
Sorry, I mean, I feel all right, but I'm not okay. Why would I choose to fight? The same thing happens anyway. I won't let nothing clip my wings. I'd rather take my chances in the dark. I mean, you know, you're painting a story of a pretty serious illness there. You know, I mean, what sort of situation and what sort of affliction lead you to a place like that to write a song like that?
It was a long time coming from years and years of abuse to my body, you know, and so my pancreas basically melted. And, you know, I never even really realized what pancreas is or any of that stuff until then. And I guess it was pretty hardcore, you know. I never felt like that I was dying, you know, even though I was being told that could very well happen. I never felt like that. And everything else that I've lived through in my life, if there's one thing that's clear, is that I'm supposed to be here for some reason. And so that's, it's like, why do this and why do that? Because, you know, all the way through my life, you try to do the other thing. You try to do it, what everyone's told you is the right thing to do and this and that, and nothing changes. You still get the same results, you know, and that's what that line means, you know?
Yeah, and the situation, I guess, maybe your personal situation and also the situation we were all in last year, how big a role did that play in you sort of making contact with Chip and I guess sort of, you know, reconciling to an extent?
What, you mean this dad experience?
Yeah, and I guess coupled with we're all in lockdown, you know what I mean? So,
well, some business things that came up, is it was responsible for Chip and I talking again, and I'm glad that happened, because that was really really fucking my head up pretty badly, and I'm glad that we're at a point right now where we can talk and act as friends or whatever and have input into each other's lives and careers again, you know, like he's on my new song, my next single and video, and which is going to be really great. He's on that, and I just send him something and he'll play the bass on it and send it back to me, so it's kind of got the best of both worlds, you know. I don't have to deal with all the fuckery, but I still get the best bass player in the world.
I said we'll move on to that next, but I warned you before you come on that for the people listening on the podcast, we're going to play a song now. What song can we play there, Johnny?
Oh, I don't know. Any one of them is as good as the other. You choose. Okay. Flip a coin.
Okay.
There's about 300 songs to choose from. Just run your finger down and just stop anywhere. They're all as good as the next.